What is up, crime crew? Welcome to Murder Unscripted's Forensic Fridays. Every other Friday, we bring you a bite-sized dose of true crime, shorter than our full-length episode, but still packed with the same jaw-dropping chaos and deadly detail. I'm Ed, and today I'm sharing an incredibly sad case that I've literally known about since I was a child, and that's the murder of local real estate mogul David Swinehart. And this is a case that I eventually went on to help produce for ID's Deadly Affairs with Susan Lucci about 10 years ago. And I have to say, it was pretty awesome getting to bring this childhood campfire story to life. David thought installing a secret recording device on his home telephone would give him answers to his marriage problems. He had no idea those tapes would eventually help solve his own murder. This is a story of betrayal, greed, and a crime that shocked Pottstown, Pennsylvania. In the early 1980s, if you'd lived in Montgomery County, like me, you've probably known the name David Swinehart. He wasn't some guy born with a silver spoon in his mouth. David had built everything himself from the ground up. He started small, working on residential projects here and there, and gradually turned himself into one of the most successful real estate developers in the area. His fingerprints are literally all over Pottstown and the surrounding communities' homes, apartment complexes, and commercial buildings. When people saw his work, they knew it was quality. And from the outside looking in, David had nailed the American dream. He had money, a thriving business, and respect in the community, and a gorgeous wife named Patricia. He seemed like the kind of couple who had it all figured out. Lived well, socialized with the right people, and looked picture perfect together. But we all know how that goes. What you see on the surface rarely tells the whole story. So by the early 80s, David and Patricia's marriage was already in serious trouble. Whatever love and connection they'd once shared had completely evaporated, replaced by a cold distance that you can practically feel when you are around them. Friends who visited their home noticed it immediately. There was this tension in the air that made everybody uncomfortable. And the conversations between them were, they're clipped, they were careful, they were constantly walking on eggshells, and that's no way to live. Their body language screamed that these two people could barely stand to be in the same room together. Like, you'd see it at parties too. They'd arrive together, but within minutes, they'd be on opposite sides of the room, each kind of doing their own thing, barely acknowledging the other person existed. And the arguments, well, they were becoming more frequent. Sometimes they'd try to keep it quiet and hushed, tense conversations behind closed doors. Other times, not so much. Neighbors would occasionally hear raised voices coming from the Swinehart place late at night, but they couldn't really make out what was being said. But naturally, people started talking. That's what happens in close-knit communities when prominent couples start showing cracks. Whispers start circulating. Maybe there were affairs, maybe money problems, maybe some other issue that they were keeping under wraps. A few concerned friends tried reaching out, and they offered to listen to either David or Patricia if they needed to talk, but both of them were keeping pretty tight-lipped about whatever was really going on. David, though, he was struggling more than most people realized. He had this gnawing feeling in his gut that something was seriously wrong. He suspected Patricia was cheating on him, but couldn't really prove it. It was driving him crazy. And he'd noticed these little things like phone calls that ended the second he would walk into a room. There were these vague excuses about where she was going, what she was doing, she'd leave it all like odd hours. Too many coincidences and half-truths that didn't quite add up to David. And that uncertainty was eating him alive. He wanted to confront Patricia, but what if he was wrong? What if he was just being paranoid? And if he was right, could he handle knowing the truth? Unable to deal with the not knowing, David made a decision that would ultimately be incredibly significant. He decided to spy on his own wife. David installed a recording device on his home telephone line. And it was pretty basic technology compared to today's standards. It was essentially a wiretap, but it would do the job. Now, was it legal? Absolutely not. Was it a massive invasion of privacy? Absolutely. Pennsylvania is a two-party state, so if one person's recording the other needs to know about it. But David was past the point of caring about any of that. He really just needed to know what was going on in his marriage. So for days, maybe even weeks, David secretly recorded Patricia's phone conversations. He'd wait until she was out of the house or busy elsewhere, and then he'd sit down and listen to the tapes, hearing every word that his wife said, and she thought no one was listening. Can you imagine what that must have been like? The dread, the anxiety. Like, I suspect that part of him was hoping to find out that nothing incriminating was going on at all. But what he heard destroyed him. Patricia was having an affair, just like he suspected, but this is where it gets really twisted. So this was not just any affair. The man on the other end of the phone calls wasn't some random dude that she'd met at work or an old flame from her past. It was Jeffrey DeBlas, her nephew, her own nephew. Think about that for a second. Like, not only was his wife cheating on him, but she was doing it with a member of their own family. Like, a young man who was probably someone David knew, someone he'd welcomed into his home, shared holidays with, treated like family, went on vacations with. Crazy. But the betrayal wasn't just about the infidelity. It was about the complete violation of boundaries that most people consider sacred. And David was obviously absolutely devastated. The recordings confirmed his worst fears and then took a place that he probably never imagined. David was absolutely devastated, with good reason. He felt humiliated, enraged, and betrayed on every level possible. People who talked to David during this period said he seemed like a man on the edge, consumed by anger and confusion, and just trying to figure out what the hell to do with this information. And some people say David confronted Patricia about the affair, while others think he kept quiet about what he knew, maybe planning his next move or consulting lawyers about a divorce. We don't really know for sure what happened in those final weeks. But what we do know is that the discovery set off a chain reaction that would eventually lead to David being dead. So January 15th, 1982 was one of those brutally cold Pennsylvania winter nights. The kind of cold that cuts right through you, makes your bones ache, sends everyone running from the car to the house as quickly as possible. It's the kind of night where most people just stay inside, bundled up, trying to stay warm. But that night, Pottstown police officers were doing their regular patrol through the quiet, frozen streets, and they spot something unusual. A car parked by one of the apartment complexes on the east side of town. And this isn't just any car. When I'm saying, this car, David's gigantic red and white Cadillac Eldorado. It's a car that everyone had associated with him. The thing was a boat and stuck out like a sore thumb, but it was David's. It was his personality. But the positioning of the car was weird. It wasn't really in a parking space. It looked more like that someone had just left it there in the back lot and walked away. So officers decide to check it out. And as they approach the car, they shine their flashlights through the windows and they see something that makes their blood run cold. David Swinehart was slumped over in the driver's seat, clearly dead and frozen solid. Within minutes, the scene transformed into a full-blown crime scene investigation. Police cars surrounded the area, their lights flashing red and blue through the darkness. Detectives were called in, and as they carefully examined the scene and David's body, the full horror of what had happened became clear. David had been savagely beaten, multiple blows to his head, kind of strikes that would have devastating, probably fatal, each on their own. But whoever killed him didn't stop there. David had been stabbed at least 14 times. 14! And the wounds were so concentrated in his back and buttocks, but it wasn't a quick kill. This was overkill in the truest sense of the word. It was brutal, it was frenzied, and it was deeply personal. And this is the weird part. My whole life, like ever since I was a kid, I'd heard rumors that David's manhood was cut off and stuffed in his mouth. And when I ended up interviewing the DA, Bruce Castor, for the episode of Deadly Affairs, he told me that wasn't true, but he'd heard that too. So it's just crazy how these stories can manifest and spread over the years. But regardless, whoever murdered David Swinehart didn't just want him dead. They wanted him to suffer. And side note, David's body was moved to the hospital for an autopsy. However, we talked about him being frozen. They needed to wait almost 24 hours for David to thaw out, basically, before conducting his examination. So meanwhile, detectives continued processing the scene, and something bothered them. Despite the brutality, all those stab wounds, the beating, there just wasn't enough blood inside the car. Anyone who worked homicide knows that a person stabbed 14 times is going to bleed a lot. But the car's interior didn't match what they expected to see. But that led to the revelation that David was probably killed somewhere else, somewhere more private, more controlled, where the killer had time and space to do what they did, and he was put in his car. They moved his body and positioned it in the driver's seat in that apartment complex. But why go through all this trouble? The staging was deliberate. Whoever did this was trying to make it look like something it wasn't. Like maybe a carjacking gone wrong, maybe a mugging, some kind of random violence by a stranger who happened upon David in the wrong place at the wrong time. By dumping the body in a car behind an apartment building, the killer probably hoped police would just write it off as a crime of opportunity. But the detectives weren't buying it. Like, everything about this screamed premeditation. This was a carefully planned and executed murder, with an attempt to throw off the investigation. And when they started digging into David's personal life, a picture emerged that made it pretty clear who wanted him dead and why. The investigators started by talking to people who knew David, and pretty quickly they learned about the state of his marriage. Friends who'd been hesitant to gossip about the Swineharts before are now coming forward saying everything they know. And the tension between Patricia and David, the rumors about the affair, the arguments, was all coming out. But then detectives stumbled upon something pretty major. David had a life insurance policy worth over $500,000. And in 1982, that was an absolute fortune. And who was said to collect on that insurance policy if David died? Patricia Swinehart. So as they keep digging into Patricia's life, they obviously uncover this affair with Jeffrey DeBlas, but Jeffrey wasn't the only DeBlas brother on their radar. His older brother Thomas soon caught their eye too, and the theory that started forming was chilling. Patricia wanted out of her marriage, but a divorce would mean splitting the assets, potentially losing control of her comfortable lifestyle. But if David died, she'd get all that insurance money, no splitting required. And Jeffrey wanted to be with Patricia without all the sneaking around. And for Thomas, maybe it was motivated by loyalty to his brother, maybe the promise of a cut of that insurance money. Perhaps both were willing to be the muscle, the guy who actually did the killing. It's a conspiracy based in lust, greed, and a complete lack of moral boundaries, but having a theory and proving it in court, those are two very different things. And here's where the detectives find themselves in a really frustrating spot, because they were pretty damn sure they knew who killed David and why. They had motive, they had the insurance money and the affair. They had suspects with clear connections to each other and to the victim, but what they didn't have is hard evidence that would hold up in court. And because those secret recordings David made, the ones that exposed Patricia's affair with Jeffrey, could have been incredibly valuable evidence. Conversations on those tapes might have established motive, could have established premeditation, and even captured the discussions about getting rid of David. But there was a huge problem, because as I mentioned earlier, those recordings were very illegal. David had recorded those without Patricia's knowledge or consent, which made those completely inadmissible in court. And any evidence that came from those illegal recordings could be challenged as quote-unquote fruit of the poisonous tree, which is legal speak for evidence that's tainted because it came from an illegal source. Without those tapes, prosecutors couldn't build a strong enough case. They had suspicions, circumstantial evidence, and theories about what happened, but nothing concrete enough to build charges that would stick. The Montgomery County District Attorney's Office had made a tough call. They decided not to charge anybody, at least not yet. And so, despite having clear suspects and an obvious motive, David Swinehart's murder became officially a cold case. From 1982 to 1985, the case just sat there, unsolved. And for David's family, who believed Patricia was innocent, those years were filled with frustration and grief, wondering if they'd ever get answers. For those who were convinced Patricia and the DeBlas brothers were guilty, it was torture watching the people they believed were murderers walking around free, going about their daily lives as if nothing happened. Patricia kept living in the area, and she collected on David's life insurance policy, as we thought she would, and Jeffrey and Thomas DeBlas went about their business too. Anyone watching from the outside would think they'd gotten away with murder. But underneath all that normalcy, the investigation never really stopped. Detectives kept working the case, although always looking for a new angle, hoping to find a witness to come forward, maybe that one piece of evidence that could crack the case wide open. They kept pressure on all these suspects through occasional follow-up interviews, making sure everybody knew the case wasn't going away, that they were still watching. When the breakthrough finally came, it wasn't anything investigators had expected. It came from inside the conspiracy itself. In 1985, 3 years after David's murder, Jeffrey DeBlas did something that shocked everyone involved in the case. He approached authorities and said he was willing to cooperate with the investigation. But why? That's the million-dollar question that we've never actually gotten a clear answer to. Maybe the guilt was finally too much to live with, maybe things soured between him and Patricia, and without that relationship, he had really no reason to stay silent anymore. Maybe he was scared of his brother Thomas, maybe worried that he would take the fall if evidence ever surfaced. Or maybe investigators had just applied the right amount of pressure at the right time, making him realize that his cooperation was in his best interest. Whatever the reasons, Jeffrey started talking, and what he told investigators was exactly what they'd suspected all along. According to Jeffrey, his brother Thomas was the one who actually killed David with a baseball bat and a knife. Thomas had done the beating and the stabbing. Patricia had known about the plan and had encouraged it. She wanted it to happen. And Jeffrey described a conspiracy from a toxic mix of forbidden desire and financial greed. Patricia obviously wanted her husband dead to collect all that insurance money, and also so she could be free to be with Jeffrey without hiding. Thomas had been brought into the plan either because of family loyalty or because he was promised a cut of the money. But Jeffrey's testimony wasn't enough. Prosecutors had learned their lesson with the illegal wiretap recordings. They needed more than just some conspirator's word against another. So they needed hard, legally obtained evidence that couldn't be dismissed by one brother trying to save his own ass. So Jeffrey agreed to do something incredibly dangerous. He agreed to wear a wire. And over the next weeks and months, Jeffrey DeBlas had conversations with Thomas and others allegedly involved in David's murder, all while wearing a hidden recording device. Like, think about how nerve-wracking that would be. You have to act completely normal and cool, like nothing's going on, as you're trying to steer this conversation toward murder to get people to confess to something. Crazy stress. Bottom line, if Thomas or anyone figured out that Jeffrey was wearing a wire, things could have gone very, very badly. These were people who'd already killed once, but Jeffrey went through with it, meeting after meeting, conversation after conversation, all being recorded. And the tapes he helped create were damning, to say the least. They captured admissions, discussions of details that only someone involved in the crime would know, and other evidence that prosecutors could actually use. And unlike David's phone recordings, those body wire recordings had actually been made with proper legal authorization with court approval. They were actually admissible evidence. After more than 3 years, prosecutors finally had what they needed. On May 11, 1985, police executed search warrants across Montgomery County. It all happened so fast. It was a calculated effort to arrest these people all at once. Thomas DeBlas was arrested, and Jeffrey was taken into custody too, despite the fact that he cooperated because he'd still been part of this conspiracy and there would be legal consequences for that. They got Patricia Swinehart too, and police brought in two other people who were alleged accomplices to the murder, but their roles were kind of unclear, so I'm not going to go there. This news exploded across Pottstown and the surrounding area. After 3 years of rumors and questions, the case was finally moving forward. The headlines were sensational. Wealthy developer's widow arrested for allegedly orchestrating her husband's murder. That's big news around here. This just, we say it all the time. This doesn't happen here. This doesn't happen here. But her two nephews were charged with carrying it all out, one of them who she'd been having an affair with. It was the kind of scandalous story that dominated headlines for weeks. People just could not stop talking about this. People still can't. I still hear about the Swinehart case. It's insane. But if anyone thought the arrest warrants meant justice would be swift, they were for a rude awakening. Because what came next was a legal battle that would drag on for over a decade. The defense attorneys for Jeffrey, Thomas, and Patricia all came out swinging. They challenged absolutely everything about the prosecution's case, filing motion after motion, appeal after appeal. They had argued that the body wire recordings violated Pennsylvania wiretap laws. They said David's illegal recordings, even though they weren't being used as evidence, had tainted the entire investigation. And they challenged the chain of custody for physical evidence as well. They were grasping at any straw they could imagine. But their biggest argument was about the delay. 3 years between the murders and the arrest. That's a long time. And the defense argued that it violated their client's Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. And honestly, it was a pretty compelling argument. 3 years is enough time for memories to fade, witnesses to disappear or die, and for evidence to be lost. The defense claimed that delay had made it impossible for their clients to get a fair trial. But the case bounced from one court to another, trial courts to appellate courts, back again, legal briefs piled up by the hundreds, oral arguments were held, then held again, and the case became famous in Pennsylvania legal circles, raising important questions about surveillance evidence, the right to a speedy trial, and acceptable investigative techniques. The years kept passing, and it was kind of becoming old news to people around here, though obviously not to David's family or those who still believed that justice was going to be served. And finally, in the mid-1990s, more than a decade after the murder, Pennsylvania Supreme Court issued rulings that allowed the trials to move forward. So the court acknowledged that, yeah, these delays have been significant, but those delays didn't rise to the level of constitutional violation. The trial could proceed. So when they did finally happen, the outcomes were complicated, I guess is the best way to put it. So Thomas DeBlas was convicted of first-degree murder. The evidence against him, especially Jeffrey's testimony in those body wire recordings, convinced the jury that Thomas had been the one who actually killed David Swinehart. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He's not getting out, ever. Jeffrey DeBlas, despite his cooperation with authorities, was also convicted of first-degree murder. His role in the conspiracy made him legally culpable for David's death, even though he hadn't been the one wielding the knife. He got life too, though his cooperation was noted for the record. But Patricia Swinehart's trial ended very differently. So despite being at the center of the prosecution's entire theory, the woman who allegedly wanted her husband dead for the insurance money, who supposedly encouraged the murder, Patricia was acquitted of all charges. They found her not guilty of anything. And why? That's the big question. It's something people still debate to this day. Maybe it's the fact that the jury felt the evidence against her was too circumstantial. Maybe they believe she'd been manipulated by the DeBlas brothers rather than being the one pulling the strings. But it's possible that all those years of legal battles had weakened the prosecution's case against her specifically. Or maybe the jury simply had reasonable doubt about whether she'd actually been involved in planning the murder. Whatever the reason, Patricia walked out of that courtroom a free woman. So her acquittal remains pretty controversial to this day. There's people around here that still believe that she was the mastermind. The one who stood to gain the most from David's death, obviously, and that she somehow managed to beat the system. And her acquittal remains incredibly controversial to this day. There's a lot of people around here that believe she was the mastermind, the one who stood to gain the most from David's death, and that she somehow managed to beat the system. And others think the jury got it right, that Patricia was just a woman caught up in something that she couldn't control. We'll probably never know the whole truth, but Patricia has maintained her innocence and has lived quietly since the trial, mostly staying out of the public eye. I would too. The DeBlas brothers, they're still in jail. They're not getting out. Their entire lives are defined by their roles in this one single act. And they're both serving life sentences for a crime rooted in greed and forbidden desire. The case itself has had a lasting impact beyond just the people involved. Commonwealth versus DeBlas is still cited in Pennsylvania court records, especially in cases involving wiretap evidence, surveillance, and speedy trial issues. Law students in the state still study it as an example of how evidence gets challenged and how constitutional rights work in criminal cases. But beyond all the legal precedents and courtroom drama, the murder of David Swinehart is a deeply human tragedy. It's about trust broken in the most intimate way possible, and how greed can destroy family bonds and push people to do terrible things. It's about the difference between how things look on the surface and what's really happening underneath. There's something really dark and ironic at the heart of this whole story. David Swinehart's paranoia, that instinct that drove him to tap his own telephone, and to spy on his wife, ultimately helping to solve his own murder. Those recordings, even though they weren't used as evidence themselves, they pointed investigators in the right direction. They established a motive, gave detectives a roadmap for whom to investigate, and it set in motion a chain of events that led to these arrests and convictions. It's been over 4 decades since that frozen January night when police found David Swinehart's body in his car. And the apartment buildings that he built, they're still standing throughout Montgomery County, silent reminders of a man whose life was cut brutally short. For people who knew David personally, the pain has probably never fully gone away. By all accounts, he was a hardworking guy who built something from nothing, who took real pride in his work. Honestly, David Swinehart around here, his name holds weight. Like when you know you got a Swinehart property, you know you got something good. In his case, it's a haunting reminder that sometimes the real danger doesn't come from strangers. Comes from the people closest to you, the spouse who sleeps next to you, the family members who show up for holidays, people who know your weaknesses and your vulnerabilities because you've trusted them with that knowledge. It's also a reminder to pay attention when relationships turn toxic, to take that betrayal seriously, and to recognize that when huge amounts of money are involved, some people are capable of almost anything. But maybe most importantly, it's a reminder that appearances mean absolutely nothing. David and Patricia literally looked like they had their life together, but behind closed doors, were living a nightmare. One that would end in murder, shattered families, and destroyed lives. I would love to hear your thoughts on this lesser-known case. And you can hit us up on socials at Murder Unscripted. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or if you want to start a conversation, join us on our Reddit page, Murder Unscripted. That's all for this week's MU Forensic Friday minisode. Join us on Tuesday for our next full-length deep dive into a case. We got some cool stuff going on, guys. We're doing a block called Drawn to Justice, featuring forensic artists who help solve brutal crimes, whether it's with sketches, with forensic molds, with this. And then we have a super cool interview at the end of the month. So check it out. And until then, stay safe, stay curious, and stay unscripted.